Directory domain, or you do not work at a business that has Active Directory, then perhaps DFSR might be boring for you. So I'm going to do DFSR first, and then we'll go into the other stuff. Now, what is DFSR? DFS itself is Distributed File System, or Distributed File Services. And the R means replication. Now, this turns out to be really spanking cool functionality in that it really solves a lot of problems that businesses have. Let's take, for example, your iDrive. On the iDrive, you have a marketing folder and an HR folder and a sales folder and maybe one for transportation or logistics or something like that. So in each one of these high-level folders is associated with a team of individuals that have access to write to those folders. But you are working at a location where that's not the only location that that business has. That business really needs those files to be accessible to their staff at another location. So in this example, let's say you have three locations, and each location has a branch office VPN tunnel, at least back to the main office. Now, it is actually possible to do either hub-and-spoke network topology or what's called a star topology. For sake of this example, let's just say that you have two remote sites and one main central site, and the two remote sites connect to the main central site. So you have a star topology. Or otherwise known as a hub-and-spoke topology for your network as opposed to a mesh network topology. Mesh network topology, by the way, is very messy. It's very, very messy. And there are some advantages to it, but you really have got to have some serious bandwidth at all the places in order to make that work appropriately. And I've seen it done very poorly in most cases, and it causes nothing but replication problems. In fact, probably since January, I've seen about 12 different environments where there was a lack of understanding on the part of the Active Directory Windows Server Master Sysadmin with regards to network topology. And they didn't understand the relationship between the actual physical layer of the network topology and Active Directory replication. Well, DFS is a portion of Active Directory. I mean, it publishes into Active Directory, and DFS doesn't exist without Active Directory. Well, I mean, you certainly can actually have non-Active Directory integrated DFS, but it's lame old way of doing it, so I don't advocate that strategy at all. What you really want to have is a DFS share that is published in Active Directory so you have resiliency. And I apologize, I'm still got a little bit of a cough from the cold that I had a few weeks ago. So you need to have your underlying network layer and replication for Active Directory actually working properly if you're going to use DFS. And really, you should get that working anyways. But now let's go back to this scenario where we have a central office, and at the central office we have this iDrive, and there's these five folders that various people of various permissions levels need to share in a multi-writer and a fully replicated way with the staff at the two branch offices. So in the past, what you would do is you would have this iDrive, and you would map that iDrive for your main office people, and you would also map that iDrive for the remote office people. The problem with that is, let's say it's a large Excel spreadsheet, then the people at the remote office, in order for them to actually open that file, they are going to have to tunnel across the branch office VPN tunnel across that slower, smaller WAN link in order to be able to open that Excel file at the main central office. That's problematic, to say the least. So DFS will solve that problem for you because it will take a replica of your main master iDrive and it will replicate it to the Windows server at each one of those remote offices. So obviously you have to have a Windows server there. And I've already said you have to have Active Directory so that you can manage the whole thing and publish it there as well. So now we get into a bit of an interesting thing that there's some additional very interesting ramifications of this. When you start using DFS, you have the ability to have high availability for your data set. Let's say in the example that the writable replica at branch office A was down. Well, the staff at branch office A would actually still be able to get to all of their files because their workstations are not being told specifically to pull the files exclusively from that server at branch office A. Because they are accessing their files through what is called a DFS namespace. So let's say it's domain.local/iDrive. Because they are accessing it through a DFS namespace, and DFS is inherently distributed and resilient, that then means that even if the server at branch office site A is down, then the staff are going to still be able to access their files on the iDrive. And that, I'm not going to say that it's going to be the same speed. No, definitely not. I mean, clearly, when they open those files and they're accessing the DFS namespace hosted at main office, it's going to be slower, but it's still going to be accessible, which is the really big deal here. Now, there are some interesting ramifications to that, however. Let's presume that you are utilizing something like QuickBooks. And your QuickBooks, you have an iDrive folder, and you have a subfolder of that called QuickBooks, and inside of that, you have all your QuickBooks database files. So it's /i/QuickBooks. So now I'm saying that your QuickBooks folder is part of the DFS namespace that gets replicated. Now, this can actually work. Where it's going to be problematic is in the circumstance where the server at branch office A is down and a staffer at branch office A is trying to open QuickBooks database files across that WAN link. Your typical QuickBooks file is anywhere from 30 to 150 megabytes in size, and I can tell you that that just really doesn't work too well across a WAN link. So you do have to be cognizant of those sorts of things. In this circumstance, I wouldn't necessarily ever suggest that DFSR in that scenario should be utilized as the methodology that people get access to their QuickBooks files. In fact, because of the nature of QuickBooks and because of the distributed nature of people needing to access it, and when I say distributed, it's obviously the people at branch office A and branch office B, and perhaps even remote VPN access would need to utilize QuickBooks. Because of the way that QuickBooks is, you're much better off doing remote desktop services, which is the effectiveness of having a terminal server set up that people can just do a VPN connection from remote, or if they're on site, they don't have to do a VPN. But either way, after that connection to the local network is established, or the private network is established, then they can just connect to that terminal server or that remote desktop server and actually utilize QuickBooks there. And you're going to find that that approach is really what is needed in order to deal with the distributed access to all sorts of applications out there that are either heavily database driven, where there is a real significant requirement for high bandwidth connectivity between the client side application and the server, and just, other scenarios where you have applications that are, well, let's say they're not as well made. I'm not suggesting that QuickBooks is not well made. In fact, I think QuickBooks is a fantabulous application. But oftentimes you're going to find that there are applications, like especially used in the medical industry, that are not exactly up to snuff with regards to the most recent strategies for making solidly compatible applications that work with IT standards and best practices of implementations for system administrative strategies. There's a tongue twister. Try that three times. Okay. So DFS is really some hugely beneficial technology. And I haven't even told you all about all the functionality of it yet. Let's imagine that you've got the need to migrate your master file server. Well, if all of your staff have been accessing their files through a DFS namespace, then all you would have to do is actually publish a new namespace server that is going to be an additional host for those folders. And then once that's all replicated and that's all fine, then you can decommission the old namespace server overnight. You would want to do it at some point in time when you're sure that no one is connecting to that server. And in that circumstance, now you have really just tremendously eased the transition from an old server to a new server. And this is super, super relevant right now because people are just going wild to get rid of their old Windows 2003 servers, as well they should. Frankly, Windows 2003 servers should have been gotten rid of about 4 or 5 years ago. But for those of you out there that have been a little late to the party, this DFS is actually a big solution for you in terms of going forward with regards to reducing the impact of server file server migrations. And really, I'm just really pleased with DFS in its distributed nature and its resilient nature. Now, there's another very interesting thing you have to realize with regards to DFSR. For those of you out there that actually manage Active Directory domain controllers, you should really take a look at your event logs. And there's these application or specialty event logs that are on your domain controllers. And you'll see one that says FRS, which is File Replication Service. And then you'll see one that's, DFS for DFSR. Well, you need to go through both of those and look to see where your sysvol replication is happening. And now when I say where, the big question you've got to ask is FRS being used to replicate sysvol? So is your sysvol replication for Active Directory being done by FRS, or is it happening through DFS? And I'll give you a really good idea that you can just like know off the top of your head whether or not you've got a big furry problem right now. Let's say your domain was originally developed or originally invented when Windows 2000 existed, or even when Windows 2003 existed. So if the very first time somebody had set up your Active Directory domain, they did so when it was Windows 2000 or Windows 2003 server. Well, in that case, I can pretty well guarantee you have FRS, unless you've done a DFSR migration for sysvol. So this is super mega relevant because FRS is no longer supported by Microsoft. So if there is a bug in FRS, well, Microsoft is not going to patch it. I mean, FRS is basically dead with the end of life for 2003 server. And I think we all know that is now end of life dead. So we need to be very cognizant about any Active Directory domain out there that is utilizing FRS, it needs to be migrated to utilize DFS, DFSR. Now, this is not easy stuff. I would not recommend you try this unless you consider yourself to be an Active Directory architect or a level four, a high level server architect. I've looked at the manuals for this. I've actually done it myself. There's not what I would consider to be the easiest to understand instructions out there on the internet, even including, I think Microsoft themselves has about a 52-page manual that intends to walk you through how to convert your sysvol replication from from FRS to DFSR. Well, the thing is that the risk profile for doing that is astronomical. I mean, I'm talking about you can take your entire domain down permanently because you can't roll back to FRS. There is no, there's no rollback process. And there's a, it's kind I kind of equivalent this to Active Directory domain rename, which, oh yes, I've done that as well. So Active Directory domain rename is one of those things for which there is some documentation out there on the internet, most of it produced by Microsoft. But because Active Directory domain rename is so rarely executed, most people just do not have the courage to take that thing on. Then the documentation for it is not extensive because very few people have done it. And my personal experience when I did Active Directory domain rename was that there was a lot of things that were just flat out missing from Microsoft's documentation. And obviously, when I did it, I did not exclusively look at Microsoft's documentation. I looked at basically everything that I could get my hot little hands on. And I ended up maintaining, writing, and then maintaining a document of all of the things that actually needed to be fixed when you do an Active Directory domain rename project. I mean, it's a big deal. And when there's so many things that are just not included in the domain rename documentation, then I can completely understand why someone is not, they would be a little reticent to just, oh yeah, let's do that in our production environment. Even if you build a lab and you do it, the reality is that that lab hasn't been around for a long time and it doesn't have the production things in it. You will miss key pieces. Yeah, I mean, I'm talking from experience here. Okay. So the migration from or I should say the conversion of your sysvol replication from FRS to DFSR is very similar to that. The process is most definitely more straightforward, but it has this enormous impact of the possibility of completely blowing up your Active Directory replication. I mean, it's serious. So my big suggestion to you is that you put it in your budget to figure out how to deal with that problem. And if dealing with that problem means that you need to hire a highly competent, experienced consultant who has actually done that project before, then that's what it means. If you can't afford that, well, then I suggest you read everything that you can and then take the appropriate risk mitigation methodology and do your best. But then have a backup plan as to who you're going to call to save your bacon if it does not go well. It might go well. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about perimeter security appliances doing their job when they are programmed properly. I have a perimeter security appliance, of course, as you know, and I keep it up to date, and it is pretty constantly being worked on. I program my box a few times a week. I monitor it, I have SIM logging, and I'm always very interested to see the reports that it sends me on a daily basis with regards to what did it protect me from that I didn't even know about. And I'm always pleased to see my WatchGuard Firebox protecting me. And recently, I was doing a website migration project And I was doing a lot of interesting things with WinSCP and SSH and even some SSH keys. So, like digital signing for sessions, effectively, is what that is. Well, my Firebox caught a number of very interesting CVEs, and CVEs are effectively security vulnerabilities. And it caught a number of CVEs on various websites that I was interacting with. And so one of these was a shell code vulnerability. Another one was cross-site scripting attempt, which I have to say is pretty prevalent. I mean, there's a lot of cross-site scripting attempts that go on the internet. And another one was the WebGNU bash remote code execution, very bad doo-doo. So the main moral of the story is that if you have a properly configured perimeter security appliance, the thing is going to protect you. And you don't, it's transparent. You know, it's not intrusive. It does not say, hey, I just blocked this thing. And I had no perception that anything that I was legitimately trying to get to was inaccessible. No. Everything that I needed to do was accessible, and in the meantime, the unit protected me against periphery attacks from the things that I was interacting with. And this is really, really crucial that you have a perimeter security appliance, something that is a dumb perimeter router or something that is exclusively a stateful packet inspection firewall that is doing NAT, it's a joke at this point. I mean, that is just such dead network security strategy. It's so dead. It's like more than 15 years dead. So if you're still doing that, please go get yourself a unified threat management security appliance. Okay. And you can check out some really sweet articles on my website in the resources section. So just go to qualitypluskonsulting.com and you'll find some really sweet white papers that really help you understand all about perimeter security appliances there. So let's get on to the death of ClearText. Why is ClearText dead? Well, pretty much it's because of the NSA. You know, it's not just, well, I shouldn't say that. It's not just the NSA. It's pretty much every government out there that has decided to engage in wholesale network injection. So, you guys have heard about spear phishing. Now, spear phishing is a really big deal. In fact, the Verizon 2015 security data breach report talked about how spear phishing is absolutely the largest problem, and it will continue to be so based upon their predictions. And I have actually seen a financial organization get breached, who was not my client, I might add. If they would have been using my security strategies, they would not have been hacked. But they were violating all kinds of things associated, I would say, pretty much almost every single layer of the recommended security strategy that I've got posted to qualitypluskonsulting.com. They violated pretty much every single layer of that security strategy. So, you know, when you're not even going to do basic due diligence with regards to security strategy, yeah, you're probably going to get hacked. I mean, it's just pretty much inevitable at that point. So they also got a spear phishing attack, and the bad guys got off with about 20 grand. So it was most definitely worthwhile to them. So the spear phishing, while that's a huge thing that's happening right now, it is not cheap to do spear phishing. It's very, 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 very labor intensive. It requires a lot of custom things. And so really, if you're trying to do bulk interception, you really need to control the network layer. And that is why ClearText is dead, is because every government in the world, obviously this all started with the NSA, but every government in the world is now injecting these backdoor sniffers. They're effectively man-in-the-middle attackers on every ISP out there so that they can do what's called bulk capture. And they're bulk capturing phone calls, text messages, full emails, instant messaging. I mean, you name it. Basically, they're bulk capturing everything. And even things that are encrypted, they're bulk capturing. The thing is, they may not be able to immediately ascertain the contents of those encrypted communications. But if the stuff that's being sent is being sent in clear text, well, most definitely they can immediately just not only access all of that and bulk capture it, but they can also immediately make use of it. And the problem is, if we have this sort of a network vulnerability going on and a vulnerability overall like this, then even if you're one of those people that says, oh, well, I'm comfortable with the government having that level of capability, well, if they have it, the hackers have it too. Because I think we all need to accept the reality that the government can't even protect their own stuff. I mean, when we look at the Office of Personnel Management, amongst the Navy itself getting hacked, and I mean, the Navy is no slouch, they have an entire massive security division. And if they get hacked, well, you know what I'm saying? I mean, like, it's a big, giant honeypot target. So when the government goes and gives themselves this backdoor access to everything, they're really making all of us much more vulnerable because they say, oh, well, you can trust us with this data, but then they don't protect that data. And they've proven themselves to not be able to protect this data. And it's not just the US government. There's all kinds of other governments in the world that have been hacked and breached as well by the bad guys. And so, this network injection vector is enormous. And this is exactly why in January of this year, Google, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, and I think now many others, have actually gone to HTTPS by default, which was definitely a good call. And this resulted in some challenges. Google has now enabled the capabilities for some special functionality to make Safe Search work over HTTPS, which really was a big deal. And I've now got Safe Search and YouTube for Schools working at a number of schools now. And boy, that was challenging to get to work because you don't really want to do DPI on everything, but yet you still need to be making sure that young eyes are seeing only appropriate material and that the SIPA Act is being complied with. Because if you're a school, you have to comply with SIPA. So there is a really kind of fascinating article on the death of clear text that was put out by Citizen Labs, and I will post the link to that so that you can read it at your leisure. And just as a recap, if you would like some assistance with migrating your sysvol replication to from FRS to DFSR, please do either contact me through qualityplusconsulting.com or send me an email to breakfastbites@gmail.com.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, and Chuck Wolbers, a transition and work experience teacher in the special education department at Tremper High School, also in Kenosha. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning. I'm Chuck Wolbers, your Education Matters host, and today we'll be talking about Job Corps education opportunities. From high atop the lovely Bioscience Building in the 91.1 FM WGTD studio on the Gateway Technical College campus in Kenosha, Wisconsin, your gateway to